You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, March 8th, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Cara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And we have a special guest rogue this week, Brian Wecht. Brian, welcome back to the SGU, man.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Evan is literally busy doing some Ukrainian man's taxes. Mm-hmm. He wrote us this email saying, my friend, he's like this whole horrible situation about somebody has to go to Ukraine to get their family out or whatever. And like he has to do his taxes tonight before he leaves for Ukraine.
Oh, and, poor guy.
Yeah, so Evan's like, I can't not do this. I had to miss the recording.
Yeah.
And we're not flexible, unfortunately, this week. This is the only night we can record. So no Evan, but we got Brian. Brian's visiting us in Connecticut.
I'm live from Steve's basement.
Basement, yeah.
Yep.
Oh, awesome.
Yep.
Not that you can tell, we're all just in front of computers, but yeah, he's physically here, and he was visiting because we're testing our new fully live version of the Boomer versus Zoomer game show that he's helping us develop.
Oh, fun.
Cool. It was... The set, Jay and Ian constructed this set, and it just looks so great. I'm staring at it right now. And it really is like when this thing, the first time we're going to do it live is at the no show on, what's the date? Is it
April 23rd?
Right. In Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And it's going to be so much fun to have this thing actually go live. We've done it online a few times, but this is like definitely a level up from that.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun. You know, the core of the show is we pit the four generations against each other: boomers, Gen Z, millennials, and zoomers. We have different categories of questions, and the questions are kind of balanced. So there are some questions that, you know, the older generation should have a little bit of an edge on, and then there's other questions that the young kids will definitely have an edge on. You know what I mean? So it's like, oh, who knows more about the other person's generation? It's a lot of fun. And, you know, we've play tested it several times, and the winners have pretty much spanned across the age range. So I think George is mostly writing the questions. I think he's doing a great job of sourcing them, you know?
The last couple times it's been the Zoomer.
Yeah, the Zoomer. Yeah.
Because, we're trying to make sure it's not just trivia, but there's also like other, you know, kind of mental challenge, brain games kind of stuff. So it is accessible to really anybody.
So we talked about Russia's invasion of Ukraine last week, and there's a couple of updates because we're talking mainly off the cuff, but we're trying to keep up to date as best as we can on the news. It's hard because obviously we don't have any special access to inside information. We're just basing what we're saying on the public mainstream media, basically. A lot of people have asked us, like, how does somebody follow an event like this? How do you get access to reliable information? How do you know what's reliable? We don't know. We don't have any inside track. So that we use the usual method, which is basically be skeptical of everything. Mm-hmm. If something sounds weird, double, triple, quadruple check it. Try to use as many different sources as possible and see if there's how reliable they are. Mm-hmm. And are they all sort of pointing in the same direction? But again, that doesn't totally answer your question for you, because sometimes all of the media is telling the same narrative, even though the narrative is bullshit.
Well, especially when the media is state run.
We're not even talking about like Russian media, just like U.S. media. Like, how does the U.S. media know what's going on? So, you want to just listen for clues as to like, is this speculation? Where are they getting this information? How solid is this? Like an official report from, is there a video showing the person saying the thing? Like, just as much objective information as you can. And then, of course, the internet is awash with it, good and bad, right? So there's people on, like, in the streets where the war is happening showing videos. And there's also things being shared, going viral on social media that are misinterpretations or fake. It was funny. Jay and I were talking yesterday. Jay's like, oh, did you see the video with the girl driving the tank? And I'm like, yeah, Jay, that's not real. He's like, oh, no. It's a Russian YouTuber, basically, who recorded that like a month ago and nothing to do with the invasion of Ukraine. But that's the thing. If something feels really good, like it's iconic, like it just fits perfectly, it's probably fake, right? Or if it feels too good to be true, it probably is.
You know what I've been struggling with on this is, is how best to support the people there. Like, it's so hard and to find a charity that you trust, that you think is going to actually get the money on the ground in a way that is going to benefit people.
Have you seen what a lot of people I know have been doing, which I think is very cool?
No, what?
They've been going on Airbnb and directly renting rooms from Ukrainians and then just leaving messages that say, I'm not actually going to stay here. I just wanted to support you.
Oh, yeah. Wow. You know, when I booked the Airbnb to come out to this trip to Connecticut, and right on the front page, it says, get rooms in Ukraine right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So because we know that money goes directly to the pockets of the people who own those homes or those apartments that are in Ukraine.
Oh, that's interesting.
Kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I like it.
There's one thing I wanted to follow up on, because Kara, you mentioned briefly, like, what percentage of the Russian populace, the public supports the invasion. And we've
already
I didn't
mention a percentage, by the way.
No. You just said, like, the majority, whatever, a large portion or something. It was, right. Yeah, used, vague terminology, because that's all we have is just the impressions, you know. There's certainly been a lot of protests, thousands of people being arrested. That's unusual, for Russia.
And against, like, pretty scary odds. It's not just, like, if somebody speaks up, there's no, retribution for that. Like, they could go to prison. They could face something worse.
Yeah. But
scary.
Hot off the presses, as we're recording this, an actual survey
coming
out of Russia, independent. And again, according to the article I'm reading on the Washington Post, they say that this is a good, reliable, independent, organization. And, they're having to keep the details, unfortunately, hidden just because Russia's clamping down on information coming out of Russia. But here it is. About 58% of Russians approve of the invasion of Ukraine. 23% oppose it. The rest are either don't know or on the fence, don't have an opinion or don't want to say or on the fence. And this confirming what I've heard in more vague terms, but it's the people who are against the invasion of Ukraine are younger and more urban. Right. And then it's the older and more rural people who are in support of it.
Which makes sense because they've been under this sort of propaganda regime for a really long time.
Totally.
The older people. Obviously, I think that we do tend to see those tendencies. We see similar things in the United States and in other countries, like this more kind of patriotic and singular sort of allegiance to whoever's in power. But I also worry that even those numbers, like, how honest can people be right now?
Yeah, we don't know.
Well, and how did they say how big the survey is?
Yeah, it was 1,640 adults.
Okay.
It was a phone survey. So 1,640.
It's just
adults.
Like, I don't know, if somebody called me up on the phone and I lived in Russia and they were like, do you support Putin? I'd be like, is this a trap? Yeah, of course I do.
100%. Yeah.
Like, it's scary to speak out. So yeah, I'm not sure.
Also, who's answering the phone?
True.
It's 2022. I don't know what the deal is with in Russia, if it's the same as here, but your phone, random phone rings, if you're old, you're maybe more likely to answer it.
Right.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, it's obviously an unscientific survey, but it's what we got.
It does kind of grok, Steve, with some of the emails that we've gotten from people who were like, Kara, you and Jay were talking about your sort of empathy for the Russian people whose own, whose leadership is leading them in a direction they don't want the leadership to go. But, like, do not underestimate the power of propaganda. Like, a lot of people there actually support Putin and support this war. And I'm sort of in that interesting place. Like, we often talk about, let's say, anti-vax rhetoric. Like, who is duped and who's the duper? And at what point are they responsible for being duped but then perpetuating rhetoric?
Yeah, sort of victim and perpetrator are blend together.
Yeah,
Totally.
And when you've been living under a propaganda regime for a long time, it's hard to not believe what you're fed because all of the media says the same thing.
Yeah, they're basically being told the narrative is that they are liberating Ukraine from Nazis, right? That's literally, that's the propaganda. And it's just a special, it's not an invasion, it's not a war, it's just a special military operation to liberate those Ukrainians. And they also are being told that Russians in Ukraine are being slaughtered.
Oh, like,
if you speak Russian, they'll kill you. So it's also, they're doing a humanitarian effort to save Russians in Ukraine from genocide. That's what they're being told. Yeah, just so terrible. That's all you hear. Even if you think, all right, this is half bullshit, it's still like it's a framing thing. It's an anchoring thing, right? So you're anchored to the propaganda as your starting point. And even if you try to correct for it, you're still like, yeah, but it's probably a good idea that we're going in there. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, it's harder to like completely detach from the swamp of propaganda that you're being buried in and have some kind of independent evaluation.
But if you have access to the internet and you see
but they don't.
But they don't.
Basically, they don't have access to the internet.
No. It's being censored. They can't get on Facebook. They can't get
especially
on Twitter.
In the last couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, wow.
All that stuff has been taken away. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I didn't know that.
And they also just the very last independent news network just went offline, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's scary. And this is coming from people who live in the United States, where I think it's important for us to also kind of reflect on ourselves and exercise some humility that we ourselves have our own propaganda that we, you know, our own anchoring problem.
Oh, yeah.
And yes,
yeah,
it's for sure. Completely different because we do have a free press. But in some ways, it's not that different. We've had a long national narrative of like American exceptionalism, and this is an anchoring problem that a lot of Americans come from. And so we have blinders on when we do terrible things politically and geopolitically, and we're moving from that.
Our international listeners frequently remind us of our American narrative anchoring. Absolutely. And we try to be as aware of that as we can be. And we love, you know, getting feedback from other perspectives. But also, it's not just an American narrative, Kara. There are subculture narratives within America. There is definitely a Republican narrative, a Democratic narrative, a libertarian narrative, a religious right narrative. Those are way more intense. Those sub ecosystems of information are much more insular, much more extreme, you know, much more unforgiving of information that goes against the narrative.
It kind of also just goes to show how dangerous nationalism, patriotism can be, that there's a dark side of a singular pride that people feel in their country, especially when their countries are a large military power.
So I think, for me, I think there's always a sweet spot, like there's a balance. Like, I think it's okay to be patriotic, but not nationalistic, right? Like, there's a point where you're like, I can take pride in my culture and the good things about the place that I live, et cetera. But you have to stop short of it becoming a prejudice.
We are somehow better than
jingoism.
Others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Us versus them. It's more like, we're great, you're great too. It's just all the diversity of humanity. And wouldn't it suck if we were just one homogenous, you know, culture? That would be terrible. It's great that we have these deep cultural differences and histories, and it's, you know, but we have to learn how to celebrate that without making it an us versus them or demonizing or othering, you know, different groups.
I mean, for me, in my lifetime, I feel like the real shift was right around after 9/11 was when it started to be, it started, I mean, at least in my adult, I mean, I was born in 1975. So that was I was a young adult at the time. And that's when it started to feel like people were pushing way too hard on some of the pro-America stuff. That felt like an inflection point to me. But that also might just be my age.
Yeah. It could be that's when you had those formative experiences. But you're right. I think obviously 9/11 was a watershed moment for a lot of people.
But my recollection was there was kind of a good kind of patriotism and love of country after 9/11. But of course, that gave way eventually to partisans.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Reasserting themselves.
Pretty quickly. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on. Got a lot of interesting science news items to talk about. Jay, you're going to start us off telling us about solid state batteries. Ooh. Yes. More battery news.
Yay.
Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, Steve, this one could be interpreted as good news. So as much as we'd like to have a profound breakthrough in battery technology, it's just not likely that it's going to happen. But we have more and more companies investing in battery development. And what we're seeing now is that there's an incremental change that's happening in batteries quite frequently, right? We're getting improvements in the technology coming from different parts of the battery. And this is great news because all of those small changes add up. And as we're seeing now, battery technology is making some real strides. What properties do we want out of modern batteries? You know, what do we want our modern batteries to be able to do? Well, a big one is something called energy density.
Energy density is the maximum energy, but per the volume, whereas specific energy is per mass.
We, of course, want it to recharge as fast as possible. We want the battery to last a long time. The way we gauge this is how many charge discharge cycles can the battery perform. We'd like batteries to be inexpensive and be made out of materials that don't harm the environment, and easy to get materials, of course. They need to be able to operate in a variety of temperatures. They also need to be manufactured in large quantities. And this is a part of battery production that could just literally stop new technologies. If they can't ramp it up and make tons of batteries in a factory setting, then they can't sell it, right? If they can't make them, they can't sell them. So that could kill any technology right there. We want long capacity retention. This means the battery holds onto its charge while it's not being used. And the last one is that we would prefer they don't catch on fire, right, when they're in our pockets, because, you know, this actually happens.
Yeah, they're stable.
Always a good thing.
Or in our garages, like my car was going to do, which is why I had to take it in for a recall.
Oh, boy.
Right now, lithium-ion batteries are the leading battery design that checks most of the boxes, most of the things that I listed above. There's actually four different types of lithium-ion batteries. They use different minerals, and all of the properties that they have are different depending on which minerals that they use, right? So lithium titanate, lithium cobalt oxide, lithium nickel manganese, cobalt oxide, lithium iron phosphate. Each one of these can do different things, is better at certain things than other things. All of these batteries have a liquid electrolyte core that's job is to conduct charge between the battery's electrodes. Researchers are working on a solid state version of the lithium ion battery, which is really cool. Once they work out the remaining kinks, these batteries will be able to have two times the specific energy and energy density compared to today's lithium ion batteries. This means that these batteries are going to be able to do a lot more for us. The solid state version can do this because they can use much thinner separators between the electrodes. They can also use an improved electrode that's 100% made of lithium instead of a lithium graphite combination. The all-lithium electrode is just simply lighter, which makes it better. Researchers say the solid-state batteries will have a longer lifespan and will also be safer because they're more stable, which means less pocket fires. So in the real world, this means that in one battery upgrade, your cell phone and laptop will have twice as much capacity. It's a big deal. You know, this is the type of bump that we've all been waiting for. Now consider what this will do for electric vehicles. This is where it really shines. The solid-state lithium-ion battery will add 50% more range, and on top of that, it'll weigh 25% less, which will actually give your car even more distance.
Well, Jay, so, but that example, it's you go from 350 to 500, but with a 25% decrease in your battery weight, which actually would extend your range a little bit more. So you basically, you could keep the same battery size and have a 700-mile range, or you could go to... Or you could have the same range and have half a battery that's half the size and weight, or you could compromise somewhere in the middle. The question is going to be, where's the sweet spot, right? Where, how much range do you want to pay for? And, you know, I've been driving an electric car now for about almost a year with a 350-mile range, which is great. It's awesome. But on long trips, we've done it and it works, but we would definitely appreciate more range on long trips. I would say something like 500 might be the sweet spot.
Have you gone more than 500 miles in your car?
Yeah, you just have to know where you're going to recharge, you know.
Yeah, you have to plan around it. I've done a couple trips that were not super super intensive, but even like I think my range is 260. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to go someplace that's like 240, I'm not going to risk it. I'm going to stop at a supercharge, have lunch and do 80%, you know, and then continue on my way, which is easy because it takes like 20 minutes and it's like $5.
Right. But the thing that's going to really make that better is more recharge stations. Like the first time we did a long trip with our Tesla, the hotel we were staying at said that they had recharging stations. So we get there and they had one recharging station.
Oh, no.
Which was free. And we used it to completely recharge our car overnight. But what if it weren't free?
Yeah.
Right? What if someone else were using that one station?
Yeah.
And the one night we had to recharge our car, what would we have done? Right? So that would be solved by more recharging stations.
And that's really the case out here on the West Coast. You're not nearly as beholden because there are the infrastructure is so much more built up.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this was in Maryland.
Yeah.
Like I said, these batteries are not ready for prime time. There is one real hurdle that needs to be resolved, and they are working on it. The solid-state batteries have an instability that happens between the solid electrode and the electrolyte. Lithium dendrites, which are metallic microstructures that form on the negative electrodes during the charging process, these form inside the battery. So these little dendrites can reduce and significantly do reduce the battery's lifespan. If this issue can't be engineered away, it'll kill the solid-state lithium-ion battery for good. The researchers have found solutions that either cost too much or don't scale up for manufacturing. And that's, you know, the problem that I mentioned before. But don't let yourself lose your charge just yet, because a new study shows promise that a solution was found that has a very small price increase to the manufacturing process. What they discovered was that during the battery manufacturing process, the ceramics that are used inside the batteries is the real culprit. During the manufacturing process, the ceramic components are heated, and until they get kind of soft and sticky so they can stick to themselves. Now, when they can stick to each other, when they're at that temperature, the ceramics are now picking up CO2 from the air that they're surrounded by. And that CO2 makes it forms a compounds with other material, and that material actually reduces the battery's ability to conduct electricity. So, you know, when I say this, it's going to be really obvious, but they came up with a simple solution here. They're just going to put it in an environment, like an all-oxygen environment, so there's no CO2 there, so the ceramics can't interact with the CO2 and actually do bad things. So I even have more good news. Literally today, as we record this, March 8th, 2022, a company called Gogoro and another company called Prologium, these two companies released a solid-state lithium-ion battery. Very, very cool. Now, we're going to learn more about this. You know, this is brand new information. I'm not 100% sure what the situation is. Steve, you actually had some info on this.
So their battery, they're claiming 140% more capacity than lithium-ion batteries. I guess it's always compared to what you're comparing it to. 140% increase. They have a system of swappable batteries for like motorcycles, for two-wheeled vehicles.
Oh, swappable.
Yeah. Yeah, so you basically just pull it out, you get a fresh one, and you're good to go in minutes.
You're done.
Yeah. So and that's something that we've been talking about for decades. You know, maybe this is the problem to the range anxiety, is that you just have swappable batteries. They have them. It exists. These are solid-state lithium ceramic batteries, solid-state. It's a working technology. I think they're using the older solution, which is to coat the electrodes. That works. That solves the problem. It's just expensive. So this is basically just a cheaper way to solve the problem. This is more than an incremental advance. Like this, we're shifting to a new technology from lithium ion to solid state lithium ceramic batteries. And we're going to get more than an incremental jump when the technology's fully working and scalable. So I think, again, it's working, but this will make it more scalable because it makes it cheaper to mass produce. Then we get that, you know, 100 to 140% increase in range, you know, whatever, some combination of reduced battery cost and size and increased range. And I think we're already way above the line in terms of EV technology being, you know, widely adoptable, but this would make it even more so, right? This would probably wipe away the last vestiges of range anxiety, and the technology will be fully there.
Which is good, because I don't think we're going to have gas cars much longer. I think mm-hmm. that EV is definitely going to be.
Oh, yeah. Days are numbered for sure.
Yeah.
Could be 30 years.
Yeah. Until they're completely gone, maybe, but I think that electric cars are going to own the market within the next 10. Well, we're already seeing.
Some manufacturers, 10? Haven't they said all electric by. Yeah. Some given year, right?
Well, Ford was saying 2050, I think. Yeah, yeah.
Have decided to do.
Well, listen, so in terms of like all new car sales will be mm-hmm. shifting. By the time most new car sales are EV, that'll be like early 2030s. Mm-hmm. Something like that is what we're projecting. But even when we're 100% new EV car sales, it will still take 20 years from that point to replace all of the internal combustion engines that are on the road.
But yeah. I mean, somebody...
So that puts us into the 2050s, which is why that's what people are
saying.
I see. 2050s. I wish we were 10 years ahead of where we are, though, in battery technology. It'd be nice. But still, we're in a good place, though, and it's getting better. It's definitely, we're on the steep part of the curve in terms, we're living through this transition. You know, it's going to happen.
And we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
No, absolutely.
Like there are good cars right now. There are good options available.
I love my Tesla. Absolutely love it.
Well, and especially when you think about even 5 years ago, it's just stunning how much more there is now.
Absolutely.
My car has four times the range that my first electric car had. That's four times the range for the same price.
Yeah.
Amazing.
All right, Bob. Tell me, this is a kind of a weird one. Are coronal loops not real? And what are coronal loops?
Okay, let's get into this. This was fun. So the sun was in the news this week, obviously. This time, it's a stunning hypothesis, actually, that the beautiful coronal loops that are produced on the sun may be mostly illusions, potentially forcing a dramatic new take on what's happening in the atmosphere on the sun. This is from the Astrophysical Journal. The title is The Coronal Veil, and led by Anna Milanoshenko. She's a scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, NCAR. Okay, so coronal loops. I'm going to read you a wonderful description of this from Wikipedia, which is nicely succinct. Let's see. Coronal loops are huge loops of magnetic field beginning and ending on the sun's visible surface, the photosphere, projecting into the solar atmosphere, the corona. This hot glowing plasma is trapped in the loops, making them visible. Coronal loops range widely in size up to several thousand kilometers long. They are transient features forming and dissipating over seconds or days. Okay, so that was a really good description of coronal loops. So, but maybe that definition is going to need a radical change in the near future. So we all know that the sun is hot, right? That's a no-brainer. But did you know it's so hot that it rips apart molecules, creating the most common state of matter in the universe? What is it? Say it.
Plasma.
Say it. Plasma, yes. So now the plasma's electrons and ions create electric currents, which then create powerful magnetic fields. And it's those magnetic fields that can extend to either the far reaches of the solar system, or they stay nearby where they leave the surface briefly, extending into the corona, and then dropping back to the surface. And that's what we're talking about. The plasma can get stuck in these loops of magnetic field, and it can leave, and it can't leave through the side. So it's got to just follow and then fill these magnetic arcs, creating these beautiful structures that we see so often on the sun. Now, these loops aren't easy to study, though, and that's because of the corona. The corona is the outermost atmosphere of the sun, and it's usually invisible because of the glare from the surface. But Kara has seen the corona with her naked eyes. When you saw a total solar eclipse, that's what you see of the sun. You see the corona peeking out because the glare of the sun is being covered by the moon. So that's the only time you could really see it with your, unless you have, specialized instrumentation.
And Bob, I understand that when that happens, you spontaneously break out into singing "My Corona."
Oh, no way. Is that what they do?
Yep.
Oh, no.
That's just science,
Okay. All right. In that case, what could I say?
And Brian is an astrophysicist.
Physicist.
Well, sort of.
That's what we're talking about.
Oh, my God. I love that. All right, so the corona is optically thin, and that means that it's easy to see through, which is wonderful, but it also makes it hard to distinguish structures that are overlapping each other. And that's where this wonderful 3D simulation comes in, called MURAM. It's a groundbreaking advance, really interesting advance here, that can simulate the entire process of loop formation from under the surface to well outside the surface into the corona. So it's similar to, say, if you could model the full gestalt of a zit from the oil glands beneath the skin surface up to the zit itself and then beyond your face when the zit pops. And that's my favorite analogy of 2022 so far. Now, MURAM can simulate from 10,000 kilometers below the surface up to 40,000 kilometers into the corona. And for the first time, it captures the entire life cycle of structures like solar flares. I'm not sure why they said solar flares, because I don't know if MURAM was designed to specifically recreate in the simulation solar flares, or are they applying that to these coronal loops. I'm not sure. But MURAM it's an amazing advance. So now using the simulation, they could actually take slices of the corona and isolate those loops and kind of do away with the problem of the thinness, the optical thinness of the corona. And when they did that, they found something that could be Nobel Prize worthy. I think Now, many of these loops, in fact, were not loops at all. Not all of them. They absolutely think that they found or found very good evidence of classic loops, as I described, or as Wikipedia described a couple minutes ago. But a lot of them were not loops. What the MIRAM simulation of their model showed was that many of the loops were, in fact, sheets of plasma that had these wrinkles in it, essentially folded over onto itself. These folded over sections look like thin, bright lines, exactly how the discrete loops of magnetically confined plasma looks. So now that's the essence of what they are calling an optical illusion. It looks like a genuine coronal loop caused by these magnetic field lines in the plasma, but they think it's not, many of these are not that at all. The title of their paper, the veil, the solar veil, it's like these sheets or veils of plasma that are folding over itself, creating, you know, an over density of plasma that makes them very bright and makes them stand out. And the veil itself, obviously, apparently, the veil is very difficult to see, or right now, perhaps impossible to see. It wasn't quite obvious. So the lead author, Milan Ushenko, said, "I have spent my entire career studying coronal loops. I was excited that this simulation would give me the opportunity to study them in more detail. I never expected this. When I saw the results, my mind exploded. This is an entirely new paradigm of understanding the sun's atmosphere." Now, actually, I wasn't aware of this, but this actually answers some questions that scientists have had over the years about these coronal loops. For one, the magnetic field lines of these loops should spread out the farther it is from the sun, right? I mean, that's just how it works. You guys imagine in your mind that classic image or the experiment you did in high school physics where you've got a magnet and you throw some iron filings and the filings line up along the field lines, right? And you've got that shape, that classic shape. The farther away it was from the magnet, the wider the field lines were, right? Because it's not quite as strong. So that was not happening with these coronal loops. They should have spread out the farther they got away from the sun's surface, the visible surface, the photosphere. It wasn't spreading out and it wasn't becoming dimmer. It was just as bright at the farthest extent of the loop as the nearest extent. And so that didn't make a lot of sense. And this kind of would explain that, actually. But like all good science, so this concept raises new questions then. Like, what causes the shapes of these folds and the densities of the folds, and how many of these loops are real and how many are just these folds, these optical illusions? So if this is true, then there's lots of new questions to be answered, lots more research to be done. Now, remember, this is just a simulation, guys. No matter how sophisticated it is, it's a simulation. The best answers are going to come when they can observationally distinguish a loop from a veil fold, if you will, using new types of observations and new analysis methods that haven't been even invented yet. So this is a simulation. It's a powerful simulation. It's really sophisticated, but these have not been observed. So they're going to have to come up with ways to figure out, all right, how are we going to distinguish these so that we could really get some real answers that, you know, that this simulation has pointed us to this potential new, groundbreaking discovery. So I'll end with a Milan Ushenko quote. She said, "We know that designing such techniques would be extremely challenging, but this study demonstrates that the way we currently interpret the observations of the sun may not be adequate for us to truly understand the physics of our star." Cool stuff. Wow. That's fascinating to think that a lot of these loops are not really the loops that we thought they were.
And it's not just, am I understanding this correctly, that it's not just they did the simulation of the MHD, magnetohydrodynamic equations.
Yeah.
And so it's both the magnetic field and how the plasma is moving along the magnetic fields. These are both different from what we understood before, right? Like the whole thing.
Yeah, the whole thing. Yeah.
There's a whole new structure here that we didn't understand. That's awesome.
Absolutely.
It's also worth pointing out, I mean, this set of equations for, you know, charged fluids is super, super complicated. That's why this is taking so long to get this stuff right. Like, you have these, you know, fluid dynamics by itself is nonlinear. And then when you complicate it further by having electric and magnetic fields and the fluids are charged, it's a real bear.
It's fiendishly complex. Yeah. And this is why no one has been able to run this simulation that's so thorough. Like I said, 10,000 kilometers below the surface, 40,000 kilometers into the corona. No one's done that because it's so complicated. That swath of star has so many you know, densities and temperatures and magnetic fields and all these things going on. Nobody could simulate that until recently.
All right. Thanks, guys. Kara, so we all know that one of the primary symptoms of COVID is that you lose your sense of taste and smell. If that happens, get a COVID test. You probably have COVID.
Yep.
But we don't really know exactly how that happens, but maybe we're getting close to understanding this.
Oh, cool.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Researchers have been really trying to figure out exactly what's going on and why this seems to be a sort of, as you mentioned, like hallmark symptom. Not everybody gets it, but often people do. And it usually goes away, but it doesn't always go away. And so, like, what is going on? I'm curious. So I have not yet gotten COVID, but of those of you here in the show, have any of you had anosmia when you had COVID?
I did.
You did?
In fact, that's when I tested positive for it. Mm-hmm. I think I'd had it for a few days and was testing negative, waited a day, and then woke up one morning, couldn't smell or taste my coffee. And I was like, uh-oh. And that was the day, the first day I tested positive for it.
And then
how long?
It
lasted about a week.
About a week. Okay.
And then I was back to 100% for sure within 2 weeks.
And so would you say that the other symptoms resided first and then your sense of smell came back, or it all kind of came back at the same time?
No, the smell came back a little bit later. Mm-hmm, like, yeah, for sure. The other stuff. I had felt like sort of a cold kind of symptoms version of COVID, the real mild one.
Right.
And that lasted a while. That went away. And then maybe a few days later, smell and taste came back.
So researchers across several different institutions, Columbia, NYU, Mount Sinai, Baylor, UC Davis, they collaborated together on actually, there's been a series of papers, and this is just the most recent one that came out in Cell just last month, trying to look at what mechanistically is going on. I think the kind of original hypothesis was that the actual sensory neurons in your nose, the neurons in your nasal epithelium, these cells that have sensory receptors on them, were somehow being infected by the virus. And that was the leading hypothesis until they discovered, nope, virus not getting in. Virus actually doesn't get into most cell types. This specific COVID virus. So it's been very kind of like a coronavirus. So it's been very confusing for researchers to figure out, well, what sense of smell getting knocked out? That's a pretty intense symptom. What exactly is going on? And so they did a couple smart things. They looked, unfortunately, at autopsy of human nasal epithelia to try and understand like a little bit more forensically what was going on. But they also did some experiments on golden hamsters, because who knew? Golden hamsters are apparently a very good animal model for human COVID infection. They have a similar response.
That's a species of hamster?
It's golden.
Sounds cute.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, in all of the renderings, because the paper has little pictures of it's funny, though, the hamster is actually gray in the rendering. So maybe I need to look up what a golden hamster actually looks like. And so what they did is they gave some hamsters COVID. Then they looked at what happens kind of day by day. Both behaviorally and physiologically and anatomically, to try and figure out exactly what is going on. So so the first thing that they realized is the cell itself, the neuron itself, is actually not getting infected by the virus. But there are changes that are taking place. The neurons aren't dying. The neurons remain healthy, but the actual receptors, which are encoded by proteins, are changing and they're down-regulating. So the receptors themselves are no longer present to bind to these different smell molecules. And they're like, well, what the heck is going on there? And what they realized is that actually there's a genetic response that occurs to inflammation. And inflammation seems to be the major actor here, that similar to that cytokine response that we see in a lot of different areas of kind of the disease process, and especially in COVID, we're starting to see more and more, and especially in long COVID. In other diseases where you lose your sense of smell, I shouldn't say diseases, but infections where you lose your sense of smell, it's mechanistic in that there are, like, you literally get snotty. There's like mucus that like blocks up your smell receptors. Like there's stuff in your nose that's preventing you from being able to smell. And you've got a stuffy nose. But many people with COVID don't have a stuffy nose.
Yeah, I didn't.
Yeah, right? There's nothing going on. So you're like, why can't I smell? My nose feels fine. But what happens is that you get this viral infection and you immediately have an immune response. That immune response sends these different factors, these different cytokines that are there to help protect the cells from, you know, further viral decimation, but sometimes can actually harm us in ways that we don't really account for. And in this specific case, there's a big focus on these cells called sustentacular cells. By definition, sustentacular cells are simply like supportive cells. So they're cells that are near other specialized cells that sort of maintain structure, but they don't necessarily have a specialized function. So when you look at the nasal epithelium, you have all of these different sensory neurons, these smell neurons with these smell receptors on the very, very end. And in between them, there are all of these sustentacular cells. And what looks like is happening in this specific kind of disease process is that the sustentacular cells are becoming infected and they are releasing a signal that kind of tells the neurons that usually detect odors to reorganize their genetic makeup and stop expressing olfactory receptor genes. And so when they stop expressing those genes, they stop creating the proteins and the receptors themselves are downregulated, and then you can't smell. It's a fascinating process that these local cells are actually telling these functional cells to change at the genetic level, usually temporarily. I think 90%+ of cases are temporary. But because the neurons themselves do not die, they are not infected and they remain intact. So often after the infection is gone, after you have that local immune response, they're able to reorganize back to normal. And you can smell again. Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really interesting because the first assumption is like, oh, the virus is infecting those cells.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes the simple explanation turns out not to be true.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, I think we're learning that more and more with inflammatory response in especially infectious disease. That you know, in some simple infections, there's like this normal course that we can look at and say, okay, whatever cell gets infected, whatever proteins are changing, blah blah blah. And then we see these other examples where there's a cytokine storm or where there's a hyperimmune response that actually leads downstream to more symptomatology and sometimes to more difficulty in recovering from the disease. And so this kind of area of infectious disease research, which is looking at these inflammatory responses, these sort of natural responses to infection that actually can cause quite a bit of damage, is a really interesting and I think quite cutting edge area of research, because it's not uncommon that, as I like in a New York Times article that covered this, they called it the immune system's friendly fire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a lot of...
Mm-hmm.
Do people know much about, I mean, I'm sure they know a lot. I don't know anything about treatments for this. Does this help at all with people who have lost their sense of smell for months or in some cases a year now?
Well, from what I understand, there are no treatments for anosmia.
There's right. No active treatment, no.
Yeah, like across the board, even in other incidences, like pre-COVID, you know, when people have lost their sense of smell due to neuronal insult or due to different problems with the cellular architecture, from what I understand, there is no treatment for anosmia at all.
No, you learn to live with it. That's the treatment, learning how to live with it.
Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly. So last news, I'm going to talk about the effects of alcohol on the brain. And this is an interesting topic on a number of levels. I remember going back to like my medical school days, which was 30 years ago, when the bottom line kind of shifted over time, right? So the question has always been, is alcohol directly toxic to brain cells? Or are alcoholics clearly have bad brains? You know, they have impaired cognitive function and brain atrophy, et cetera. Is that due to things that go along with alcohol, right? Is it due to malnutrition? And I know that was sort of the thinking when I was in medical school. That's basically the malnutrition, and it's not the direct toxicity of alcohol. But that really has been an open question, and the data has gone back and forth over the years on that. It's hard to like fully tease it apart because alcohol is so comorbid, like heavy use of alcoholism, so comorbid with other health things that would affect your overall health. But what we have now is a new study, which is the largest study to look at this directly at this question. There are 36,678 subjects in the study published in Nature Communications last week, And they had, this comes from a UK data page where they had data on imaging from the UK Biobank. They have data on imaging so they could have overall brain volume, gray matter volume and structure, and white matter structure in the brains of over 36,000 subjects, and also reports of their daily alcohol consumption. So they were able to, as well as lots of other demographic data, and that's important. So they were able to see if there's a correlation here. And because they had a very powerful database with a lot of information, they were able to control for a host of possible confounding factors, such as age, height, handedness, sex, smoking status, socioeconomic status, genetic ancestry, and the county of residence. This is, again, in the UK. Just, you know, if any of those factors had any influence on the, you know, the measures of brain volume, they would control for that. And then they tried to isolate the amount of alcohol people used on average as a factor and see what does this correlate with brain volume, basically. They broke it down into units of alcohol, of daily alcohol use, with one unit basically being half a drink, like half of a beer or half of a glass of wine. So, and what they found was that as little as 2 units or one drink per day on average was associated with a statistically significant decrease in brain volume. There was a pretty clear dose response curve, and it was non-linear, so that as the number of units of daily alcohol increased, this effect became greater, right? They also looked at the data in an interesting way. They said, if we use all the other factors to predict what the brain volume should be for this person, right, based upon their age, height, sex, smoking, blah, 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 then we could say, how old does their brain look compared to their actual age, right? That makes sense?
Uh-huh.
So they say, mm-hmm. if the what does the factor of alcohol use correlate to in terms of, like, if we replace that with age, what would it say, like, the equivalent in terms of the effect of aging? So one, that there was no difference between 0 and 1 unit, so 0 a day and a half a drink a day, there was no statistically significant difference. Between 0 and 2 units, or one drink per day, your brain looked 6 months older than if people who had, you know, 0 drinks per day. So that doesn't sound terribly significant. You know, I personally find every one of my brain cells to be precious, but you could make that decision for yourself. But here's the thing, at 4 drinks per day, the subjects' brains looked 10 years older.
Mm.
10 years. Mm. So now we're talking, that's significant. That's a significant amount of a volume loss and aging, you know, on the parameters that we were discussing. So this seems to be independent of all these other factors. And this supports the conclusion that alcohol itself is an independent risk factor for, you know, damage to the brain over time. As interesting as all that is, what's also interesting just to think about the general scientific questions about this kind of data and how we address these questions, to put it into context. So one context that's important to note is the previous data, right? It's never been controversial, at least not over the last 30, 40 years, that heavy alcohol use is associated with brain damage.
Oh,
that,
for sure.
Alcohol itself, you know, when you get to heavy use. But the question was, how much does that extend to less and less amounts of alcohol use?
Mm-hmm.
This is a generic question that comes up with every time we look at a toxin and say, how toxic is it, right? And so we want to know, what is there a threshold, and is the toxicity linear? So for some substances, for example, we say it's linear, no threshold toxicity, meaning that, again, like, twice the exposure gives you twice the toxicity, and there's no lower limit as far as we could detect.
Such as, what's an example of that?
Well, smoking is now considered to be a linear non-threshold toxin, for mm-hmm. example. Like, there's really no lower limit. But the question is, how do we know if there's a lower limit or not? because for any toxin, it's going to be easier to detect at the higher exposure levels and get increasingly difficult to detect. Essentially, you could say that the signal becomes smaller and smaller. At some point, it disappears into the noise. That doesn't mean the toxicity goes away. It's just a absolute statistical mathematical phenomenon that it's going to be more difficult to detect the effects of toxicity at the lower end of the exposure spectrum. And so that signal's always going to disappear as you go down, whether there's a lower threshold or not.
And are you talking more in like epidemiological studies because there is so much noise, or even in like animal models where we can control for kind of all of the different variables?
So that's a good question. So so in any model, but the question is, I would frame it, but the way I'm framing the question is, you know, how do we know where that lower limit is? Mm-hmm. And the way we do that is to have research with low noise,
right,
or high power. Mm-hmm. Right. So yeah. Those are the two variables. So one way to get low noise is to have a rigorous design, right? To do an experimental study, mm-hmm. for example. So we can't do that in humans. You can do that in animals. But animals don't always behave like humans. And like, for example, with smoking, we've had a hard time proving.
Absolutely. We had a hard
time.
That
smoking causes cancer through animal models because they just don't behave the way humans do. Mm-hmm. And also it's unethical. You can't randomize people to how much alcohol they're going to drink. Here, have 5 drinks a day. I want to see how much it damages your brain, right? You can't get approval for that study. So we have to content ourselves with other kinds of studies, mainly observational, right?
Yeah.
Where we're just asking people how much they do drink and then correlating that with something. That doesn't mean we can't ever get to a confident causal conclusion. It just means we have to triangulate a lot of data.
And we have to collect a lot of
different ways of looking at it. So if you look at it in multiple different ways, like one thing that's always nice to see, if there's a clear dose, a consistent dose response curve, that supports a causal toxin effect, right? Because usually when it's an epiphenomenon, it's a confounding factor. Usually it doesn't follow a strict dose response curve. When it's a biological toxic effect, it usually does. So again, it's not ironclad, but it definitely pushes us in the direction of saying this is a direct toxic effect. The other way you could do is to have a really powerful study, and that basically means more subjects. So that's what this study is doing. They're saying, all right, if we can come up with a database where we can get tens of thousands of subjects, make a super high powered study, we'll be able to probe farther down the spectrum of lower and lower exposure. And when they did that, they found, it tracks. It continues all the way down to the limit of the power of the study. Mm-hmm. And so that suggests that the threshold is at least really low, if not no threshold, from a practical point of view. So that's, again, what this study kind of suggests, is that the more we look, the more subtle toxicity we're seeing. And if we had a even more powerful study, would we see a statistically significant change, even at a half a drink a day? Maybe. Or maybe, but we don't know. It's certainly biologically plausible that there is a threshold effect, right? Below which there's essentially zero toxic effect. But we know that threshold is really low for alcohol, right? It's less than one drink per day. If there is a threshold, at some point, the lower threshold, it becomes so small, it's like a distinction without a difference, right? So we're kind of getting there with alcohol. So at this point, what does all this mean? I think it means that the scientific evidence now, I would summarize it as saying, what's the relationship between alcohol and brain health? That heavy alcohol use is definitely bad for your brain health. Mm-hmm. Definitely causes brain toxicity. Moderate alcohol use probably does, and the effects are significant. When I say like moderate, like 3 to 4 drinks per day kind of thing. And then when you go down from there, like mild drinking, 1 drink a day or less, there may be a subtle negative effect there, but people can decide for themselves what choices they want to make with respect to that. But we can no longer say with confidence, not that we ever could, but we definitely can't say with confidence that like 1 drink a day is benign. We can't say that.
Because I think a lot of times people have argued that 1 drink a day is good for you.
Oh, yeah. You hear that in France, they drink, blah, 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 right?
Yeah, and the resveratrol in the wine and all of these things that they somehow might outweigh the potential negative consequences. And I think at the 1 drink level, maybe the jury's still out, but like it's not necessarily benign. That
yeah, but the that evidence has moved in the direction of no, and here's partly why. The early data that showed that moderate drinking was better than no drinking, like one drink a day was better than zero drinks a day, was an artifact of the fact that the zero drink a day category was contaminated by ex drinkers, people who quit because they were former alcoholics who then quit, and so technically they drink no alcohol, but the damage was already done. Right. Once you take them out of the data, that beneficial effect of alcohol mostly goes away or entirely goes away. And so that it made it from maybe to, oh, we really don't know now. And maybe there isn't any benefit at all.
And how long ago did people realize that? Is that recent?
That's like 10, 15 years ago. But it shows you how
rhetoric stays.
Yeah,
totally.
Those narratives get in the public. They take decades to go away, if ever. We're still saying shit that was wrong 100 years ago.
Well, but also with that one, it's like people want, you know, people want to have a drink every now and then.
Yeah.
And you know, they're like, oh, look, it's good for me. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, think about smoking. People were still talking about how smoking was potentially medicinal. Mm-hmm. Pretty late in the game.
Like it was in the 50s. Yeah.
Even after, like, the scientific community got it, but the public just didn't. And I think marketing had a lot to do with that.
Huge delay. We figured out that, my favorite example always, is that antioxidants were pretty much worthless in the 1990s. Two decades later.
I know.
And it's not going to go away in the foreseeable future. It's just too useful a branding, you know. But anyway, so, yeah, this is what the evidence shows. For people who like to drink, you just have to deal with it. This is the data. Again, you make your decision for yourself. We definitely, I think any responsible physician would advise you not to drink heavily, because there's more than just outside your brain. There's lots of organ toxicity associated with heavy alcohol use. It is a bad drug. And,
If you have a doctor that's saying, yeah, please drink heavily, that's probably a warning sign, right?
That's a red flag right there. And even moderately is bad, like basically multiple drinks per day, that's pretty bad too. You know, when you get down to like one per day or less is, I think, where it gets into the gray zone. And then even then, you got to be cautious, is what I would say.
So, Steve, you and I don't drink at all.
I don't
like
drink
ever.
All. Never
like,
have.
I don't touch alcohol, neither do you. We should enlist in some of these clinical trials. We're like unicorns.
Yeah. All right, Brian, you're like a string theorist and stuff, right?
So I am.
Give us an update. What's string theory been up to lately?
Yeah, so let me just give people a very short background on myself. So I was, I am a theoretical physicist. I was a theoretical particle physicist, and I worked on mainly quantum field theory and string theory, with a specialty in four-dimensional supersymmetric field theories. Mm-hmm. So I did that for many years. Then I quit, but I do want to emphasize that I didn't quit because I was bad at physics. I quit because I decided to be a full-time musician and YouTuber, and now I dress up like a ninja in a comedy band. So those are my qualifications.
So this is because YouTube is way more lucrative than physics, yeah?
You know what? Well, it expected value, no.
Oh, interesting.
but it can be. Uh-huh. So I think the upper end is probably much higher, for YouTube. But on average, no, for sure.
More fun?
Different kind of fun, you know? Yeah. Like there's a kind of fun that's sitting in a seminar and desperately trying not to fall asleep. And then there's the other kind of fun, which is dressing up in a ninja costume and playing for thousands of people. So, six of one.
I think some of our listeners might know your band, Brian.
Yeah, so my band, my main band is called Ninja Sex Party, and we're a two-person, I was going to say a two-person duo, but that's redundant, a duo, and we do like 80s, mostly 80s style comedy songs. And we're in year, I think it's 13 now. So I started this while I was a postdoc and then kept it going all through my faculty position and then eventually quit that job. To move to LA from London, where I was a professor, and do the YouTube thing full time.
It's amazing.
It was very scary, but I'm really glad I did it. Anyway, so the thing I wanted to talk about is you don't hear much in the popular press or even in the science press about string theory these days. I mean, this was all the rage. Probably, I wasn't quite old enough to really be paying attention, but I would imagine starting in the late 80s, you started to hear things about this amazing new theory. And for a while, people were touting it as what they called a theory of everything. So string theory, for those of you who don't know, the really simple version of explaining it is that rather than being a theory of point particles, which we usually think of the fundamental particles of nature being like an electron, a quark, or whatever, these are zero-dimensional things. They have no spatial extent whatsoever. Like, no matter how close up to get you get to them, they still look like little points. String theory is a theory of one-dimensional objects called strings. So basically little lines, and maybe they close in on themselves and maybe they don't. There are different kinds. But that's the idea, is if you look really closely at the fundamental constituents of nature, they're not zero-dimensional, but they're one-dimensional. So it turns out that once you assume that and then try to figure out the consequences, all sorts of amazing things happen, especially once you try to come up with a quantum mechanical version of this theory. And so in the 80s, people discovered this idea. I'm vastly oversimplifying it, by the way. Really, in some sense, it was discovered many, many years before that. But in the 80s, people kind of figured out how to make it really work. And then they said all sorts of things like, this is a theory of everything. It's going to explain the entire universe. There were some people who were optimistic that it would be like kind of just a follow your nose thing. Start at point A, which is a string theory. And then a few years later, we have, oh, we live in a three-space, one-time dimensional universe with this set of particles and everything that we know. Now, you would know if that had worked, because it definitely did not. It turns out that string theory was not just a straight line, and in fact is vastly more complicated than people realized originally. And I'm not even talking about, you know, just the complexity of the language of string theory. There are all sorts of, as we understand it now, different possible universes that might be consistent with string theory. So an interesting development happened here in the, I don't know, it was probably 10 or 15 years ago. There was something that kind of erupted into the public consciousness. People often call it the string wars, where there were some prominent bloggers and other types, Peter White, Lee Smolin, who were very anti-string theory and would talk about how, you know, to vastly oversimplify it again, to put it bluntly, they thought it was bullshit. And there were books published and a lot of ink expended on this topic. But that was, 10 or so years ago, and you haven't heard much from people on what's been happening lately. But by the way, let me just say that the version of, you know, as with all things, it's a bit subtle, but I think people who said string theory is not living up to the hype were totally right about that. String theory did not deliver the promise of a unified theory of everything. And to this day, we don't understand if it is a real theory. Let me put it this way. If it describes the quantum gravity that makes up our universe, right? Is it right? We don't know. It might be right, but there is no evidence either way. It is certainly one of the very few quantum theories of gravity that we have, but is it real? Is it true? We don't know. So people who are skeptical of that were right to be skeptical, and we really don't know. But what happened along the way in the string theory is that string theory became less of an end in itself as a way to describe the universe that we see, and just that. It became kind of a fun toolbox for theoretical theories for theoretical physicists to play in. So there are all sorts of examples of this. The first one that comes to mind is called ADS-CFT. It's a discovery pioneered by a lot of people and still a very active area of research. The main person that's credited with finding it is Juan Maldacena, at the Institute for Advanced Study. And the idea behind ADS-CFT is that there's exactly the same information in a four-dimensional, by which I mean a three-space and one-time dimensional quantum field theory, that is a theory of particles, and a 10-dimensional string theory. And precisely where one theory is easy to describe, the other gets complicated. So in other words, you can start trying to investigate hard problems in quantum field theory with easy problems in string theory, and in fact, the geometry of the 10 dimensions. And people use this very, very successfully to understand all sorts of interesting things where, like, the shape of something in this particular 10-dimensional string theory controls, let's say, you know, like the spectrum of particles in some given quantum field theory. And that tells you absolutely nothing on its face about the real world. But it does help you understand a hard problem in theoretical physics, which is this quantum field theory. And we know that quantum field theories absolutely do describe the real world. And in fact, you know, some of the best tested theories out there, quantum electrodynamics, for example, are quantum field theories. So what happened, to make a long story short, as string theory kind of progressed, people found more and more applications for it in a broader theoretical physics context. And so the question I wanted to ask, or answer really, what happened to string theory, is that rather than become a theory of everything, which I do not think of it as a theory of everything, I think people of my generation in string theory probably don't either. Certainly most of the people I knew in grad school, and I started grad school just after ADS-CFT was founded in, in 98. People who started grad school around then were not raised in this kind of culture of string theory is going to solve every problem. We came in thinking of it as a tool, and that is exactly what it's become. So the complicated question, there's still a lot of unknowns about string theory. In many senses, it is not a rigorously defined theory, certainly not as rigorously defined as quantum field theory. And so what people are using it for these days are sometimes it's inspiration for solving hard problems in mathematics. The geometry of strings sometimes has interesting applications for difficult problems in algebraic geometry or things like that, or as a tool to study the structure of quantum field theories. And the hard question is, what is a string theorist? I don't know that anyone knows the answer to that anymore, because it is someone who uses string theory in a very broad context, sometimes just as inspiration.
Brian Green.
Brian
That's
Green.
That's a string theorist.
Brian Green is a string theorist. That's true.
Yeah.
He uses strings to study cosmology, as many people do. There are other people who probably would refer to them like, okay, for example, I would call a lot of my work string theory. And I did write some papers that were just straight up string theory, but a lot of it was stuff where I used string theory to study quantum field theories. Mm. So it's, you know, am I a string theorist? I mean, definitely not anymore. Now I'm a ninja. But, you know, even if I had kept doing what I was doing, I probably would keep calling myself a string theorist, despite the fact that a lot of my research has become more inspired by the toolbox of string theory than using, quote unquote, real string theory itself. Some people might see this and say, yeah, we told you it was crap. See, no one didn't do what it said. I think a more nuanced point of view is that people are now using this as a tool, as part of a larger toolbox of things to study hard problems in physics. In some sense, is that better than the original promise? No. Okay. You know, it'd be nice to have, you know, a theory of everything that explains the whole universe. But I think the problems that string theorists are facing today are still really interesting, and a lot of progress is being made. So the thing I wanted to kind of correct the narrative of here was that, oh, string, like, the string wars are over. The people who said string theory was bullshit won. That's not the case at all. There's still lots of string theorists doing some really interesting research who, from the start, viewed it as a tool to solve hard problems, and that's what they continue to do.
So, Brian, what this reminds me of as, like, a non-expert, right, just as a science enthusiast, is the Lorentz transformations, right, where Lorentz came up with a bunch of mathematical tricks, you know, to make the physics work in terms of the, like, the math work in terms of, like, the speed of light and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, but he didn't believe it was actually describing the universe. And Einstein came along and said, no, that's actually describing how the universe works. That's why it's a useful mathematical trick, because the universe is mathematical and that's how it actually functions. So I'm getting the same kind of vibe from what you're saying. Correct me if I'm wrong. If the fact that string theory, it may not be a coherent theory of everything, but the fact that it's a useful set of mathematical tools working out of real problems in physics, do you think that means that it, in, on some level, it reflects some real aspect of the physical universe?
Yeah, I think it does. Now, I do want to qualify that. Is it being used to study real physical problems? I think that is still an open question. Like, a lot of these quantum field theories that are being studied with string theory are still theoretical models. So there's a lot of effort to try to understand real condensed matter models, et cetera, with stringy inspired stuff. I don't know what the state of the art is on that, but I think people have found it challenging to use these string models to really study, like, things you might see in a lab. problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's not quite the same. The Lorentz, I mean, the amazing thing about the Lorentz transforms is that, you know, it was really, that's what led to the whole idea of relativity, right? Was noticing that the equations of electricity and magnetism were invariant under this. And then, what if all of physics was invariant under that? That's what led to relativity. That is, I think, a much more, let's say, real world thing than what string theory is currently being used for. String theory is more used to understand the structures of quantum field theory, you know, how scattering amplitudes work, stuff like that, that feels more generalized and less, for want of a better word, real.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not to say it never, I do think, to answer your question, by the way, is I do think that, you know, I don't think it is all out of the question for stringy type physics to help explain real world problems. What those specific problems are is still an unknown.
Yeah.
So I think there's some kind of stringy nature hidden there in the universe that we don't fully understand yet.
Can we change its name to stringy type physics? Because I like that better.
Yeah. Well, honestly, that really is what people are doing these days. Like a lot of quote unquote string theorists are just broadly speaking theoretical physicists who work on interesting problems that are, you know, it's at some intersection of quantum field theory, of mathematics, of condensed math. You know, there are people who are like, who identify as string theorists who work in a wide variety of things. So stringy type physics is honestly a better description for what people are doing with it these days.
What about non-string specialists? Are they embracing these new tools as well and steadfastly not calling themselves string theorists?
Well, you know, there's still a lot of holdover from people who don't believe that string theory is useful or worth doing. So I think especially among it's kind of generational, but not really. It's almost more field dependent. There's still a bunch of people who think it's just not worth doing. That to me seems ridiculous. I mean, you can point to a million examples of, I mean, probably the easiest ones are mathematical discoveries that came directly from people thinking about string theory models. So it's not like, because some problems that are hard in math are easy in when you think about it in a string theory context. And then what people did is they said, oh, here's the intuition from string theory. That gives me an idea of what might be the answer. Let me then go prove that.
Yeah.
If that was all string theory ever did, that's amazing. I mean, Fields medals have been awarded for this kind of stuff. Like, that's not,
joke.
I don't understand how you can point to that and say, oh, string theory is crap. Like it literally, you know,
it's on to something for sure.
It has given us answers that we didn't previously know.
Right.
And it doesn't just stop in math. It continues in quantum field theory. And that's the other thing is I don't understand how you can point to a deeper understanding of quantum field theory and say, yeah, who cares?
Right. You know? That's pretty damn fundamental. Hello.
Yeah.
That's quantum, one that I don't get. How could you say?
Yeah, and we've talked before about the fact that, like, even the question of is it true or not, it may not be the most important thing in science at this level. It's more of is it useful? And what was the quote? Like, shut up and calculate. Like, don't worry about whether or not this is describing actual reality. Just do the math. Does the math work? Great. You know, that's the level that we're at there.
That's right. And it is an interesting question. You know, if you were complaining, hey, string theory is not rigorously defined. You know what? You're completely right. It is not rigorously defined, but that doesn't mean that it's not useful. And, you know, if there's one thing that distinguishes a theoretical physicist from a mathematician, it's not worrying so much about when things are rigorously defined. You know, like you start with kind of less rigor than a mathematician. Then you have to, you know, prove it, but not at the level of a mathematical proof. So, you know, you're allowed to throw out solutions for being unphysical. You know, they blow up at infinity or whatever. That's just kind of a normal part of doing theoretical physics. So I think it's okay to have a tool that is useful, even if you don't fully understand it.
Mm. Maybe an AI will understand it one day and they'll solve it for us.
That would be great.
That's going to happen.
Yeah.
That might happen. Seriously, like, you know, in 50 years, you might have AIs who completely explain all this and, like, humans never really understand it.
I mean, sure. I'm sure there's things that we just cannot understand ever being a baseline human. It's like a dog trying to understand algebra. Not going to happen, no matter how good of a teacher you are. And we may need to either augment ourselves or use an artificial intelligence to even be able to approach, a decent understanding of some of this stuff.
All right, Bob, give us a quickie.
Yes, thank you, Steve. Gird your loins, people. This is your quickie with Bob. nano skyscrapers in the news. Researchers have 3D printed super tiny pillar structures to house bacteria because the homeless bacteria problem is getting out of hand. So the bacteria, no laughs for Bob today. Jesus, tough crowd. So the bacteria pay for their housing by giving up electrons produced from photosynthesis to run small electrical devices. So this isn't brand new technology. You know, extracting energy from photosynthetic systems has been tried before with kind of limited success, I would say. And they kind of blamed it on the biology itself, that the biology presented these fundamental limitations that they were having very trouble getting past. But it turns out it looks like it wasn't the biology that was inhibiting this energy extraction from photosynthetic systems itself. It was the materials that were being used. Ideally, bacteria, like cyanobacteria, for them to be really efficient and do what they do best, they need to be connected to, and to tap into that, they need to be connected to electrodes, and they need to be exposed to maximum sunlight at the same time. And that's exactly what these electrode nanopillars allow. So when they colonize it and are kind of like embedded within the electrodes, and they can see a lot of light, they get a lot of light to do their photosynthetic magic, then that's when these things really seem to have taken off. This technique that they're using with these 3D printed nanopillars, it's already more efficient than other bioenergy technologies, like, for example, biofuel. And they've also extracted more than 10 times the amount of bioenergy than similar systems. So this looks very promising. I'm really curious to see where this is going to go in the next few years. So perhaps your iPhone 25 will have a longer battery life because of bacteria-laden nano skyscrapers. Probably not on your iPhone, but I'm sure that there could be lots of other applications. So, loins ungirded. This has been your quickie with Bob. I hope it was good for you too.
Bob, isn't nano skyscrapers kind of like jumbo shrimp?
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, military intelligence.
All right. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy Time.
All right, Steve, I got to do a correction from last week.
Ah.
This was a tough one because I was trying to verify the correction, and I just don't know. But someone wrote in, and they sounded like they knew what they were saying. So this was sent in from a listener named Peter Mendez Scheinberg, and he said, "You read one listener's answer who thought it was the English used in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales." Remember that noisy we did a few weeks ago?
Yeah.
So he said, "You said that it was spot on," you know, in quotes. "Actually, that's wrong. Chaucer's Canterbury Tales is written in the late Middle English of the 14th century, not Old English, which is subsequently different. Old English was spoken from the 5th century to 1066, the Norman conquest, whereas Middle English was spoken between 1066 and the late 15th century. So a few centuries out, not so spot on, but warm." So, you know, I don't know.
I think that's true. You know, I took a whole class on the Canterbury Tales in college.
Yep. And what happened? How come you didn't help me with this?
Because I do, it's 30 years ago and I don't remember much about it.
Yeah, so deferring to someone who seems to have better information, you know, I did try to look it up. It's a very difficult thing to look up because you can't just find this specific answer somewhere. You have to kind of know a lot of different things at the same time.
Yeah, the Canterbury Tales is in Middle English.
Yeah.
I thought my understanding was the correction.
No, he said, "You read one listener's answer who thought it was the English used in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales," right? So the person sent it in.
Yeah, you're correct. So it definitely was Old English, and the emailer thought that Old English was used in the Canterbury Tales, but it isn't. Middle English was used in the Canterbury Tales.
Okay.
That's the correction, and it's correct.
Peter, thank you. Thank you, Peter. I appreciate anybody with expertise that wants to write in and help us, you know, narrow down to a better answer. That, you know, it's always welcome. So last week, I played the following noisy. Okay, right? Like, what is this? Right out of the gate, you know, you guys have heard of Visto Tutti. This guy writes me all the time. But anyway, he said, "At first it sounded bird-like, and then there was an echo, like the call travels far around the landscape. So he thought it was the largest mammal, and he said only a herd animal would have such a simple call. I'm guessing an ibex. So that is not correct.
It sounds like that mummy. Do you know what I'm talking about?
You are completely correct, Brian.
It is the mummy?
It is the mummy.
What no. mummy? What are you talking about?
Really?
Yeah, they replicated the vocal cords of a mummy.
Yes. No way.
Oh, sorry. Did I give it away? Was that
no, it's okay.
I didn't know
we'll edit it
cool.
out. You can always
cool.
do that. Okay. That's fine.
Sorry.
Brian, good job.
Thank you.
So I got another listener wrote in named Phil Wyman, and Phil wrote, "Hi, Jay. In this week's Who's That Noisy? A goose after a long night at a heavy metal concert." Just kidding. "It has quite an echo on it, guessing something in a large space, possibly something sawing or drilling ice." That is not correct. I have not heard anybody sawing or drilling ice recently, so I can't make the comparison. Pedro Languna wrote in, "Hello there, longtime listener, never mailed, but here's my first guess. As soon as I heard this, the word female moose or cow came to mind, and I knew I had to make this my first guess. Love you all, but I love the podcast even more, Pedro." You know, I voted for Pedro. Did you guys know that?
Me too.
Congratulations.
Nah.
So that is not correct. But yeah, I mean, I could totally see a female moose or cow making somewhat of a noise like that. We have a closer guess. This person named Jacob Lutzen, and he said, "Is it a villager in Minecraft?"
They sound you know like that. They
Steve, doesn't like it? That. If you know Minecraft, that's funny. So thank you, Jacob, for that, because that is actually, you know, the closest funny. Guess so far. We have a winner. And in fact, we had tons of winners, guys. Lots of people guessed this one. This person who wrote in got it first, name of C. Ross. His name is Clayton, actually. And he says, "Hi, AJ. This week's noisy is 100% the 3D printed esophagus of an ancient mummy."
Hell yeah, it is.
Yep. Right, Bri? So they scanned the mummy. They made a 3D model of the vocal cords and the esophagus and the palate. And they printed them on a 3D printer. And they made air go through this. And that is the sound. And let me play that for you once more. I will tell you that whoever this mummy was, he was a very disagreeable fella.
I know. Couldn't they have, like, extended it or changed the, I don't know, the air pressure or something so he wasn't just going, meh?
It is one of, when you watch the video on YouTube of this, it is one of the funniest things because they build up to it and they're like, "And here's what it sounds like, meh." Voice of ancient Egypt.
Oh, my God. All right, guys, I have a new noisy for you this week. I hope you enjoy it. This one's pretty cool. I'm going to give you a little bit of a clarification because I think a few things are going to be obvious as soon as you hear it. But whatever is making this noise, there's two of them, right? Does that clarify things?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and by the way, this noisy was sent in by someone that you guys don't know. His name is Visto Tutti. Wait for it. Amazing.
Oh my God.
Amazing. I told you to wait for it because the ending is by far the best part.
It sounds so mad.
I know.
That's a good hint, because whatever that was, it's pissed off. So, yeah. Thanks, Brian. So, yeah, this is a great one, guys. If you think you know what it is, or if you heard something really cool this week, you know what to do. You got to email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Now, Steve.
Yeah.
Everybody likes a good show, right?
Sure.
There's all sorts of shows out there, and, you know, people are actually entering the real world again to see shows, and we have science shows for you. If you guys like science, we have a live recording of the SGU podcast. One of these shows will be done in New York City, and one will be done in Boston. This is going to be on the weekend of March 25th. And then we have two extravaganzas. If you don't know what the extravaganza is, it is a science-based variety show where we do some improv bits. You know, a lot of like competition kind of improv bits where we're competing against each other, going head to head with each other. And then we also talk to you about how you cannot trust your senses, and we show you exactly why you can't. So we have two extravaganzas happening, one in New York City, one in Boston. If you'd like to find out information on where you could buy tickets, please go to theskepticsguide.org/events.
Thank you, Jay. All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We're coming off of a sweep from last week, but this time I'm just going to do three regular news items, no theme. You guys ready?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Here we go. Three regular news items. Item number one, a new study calculates that the addition of lead to gasoline in the 20th century resulted in the loss of 824 million IQ points from more than 170 million Americans alive today. Item number two, the oldest vampiropod squid fossil discovered, 328 million years old, indicates that the common ancestors between squid and octopuses had only two arms. And item number three, a study of linguistic convergence finds that people imitate speech they hear, even parts of speech they do not hear but anticipate, such as imitating parts of a Southern American accent they were not exposed to in the experiment. All right, Brian, as our guest, you get to go first.
Okay. So I believe, let's see, I've been on the show, what, three or four times? I think I am undefeated at science, whoa, science or fiction. All right. So let's hope that holds steady. Number one, this is the lead one. A new study calculates the addition of lead to gasoline, 20th century loss of 824 million IQ points from more than 170 million Americans. My understanding is that it is the harmful effects of lead are more and more confirmed. It started out as people know that lead is bad, of course, for brain function. But my understanding is we're just starting to understand exactly how bad it is. So I'm going to say the lead to gasoline one is science. I mean, I have no 824 million. I have no sense of the magnitude of that, but I'm going to say that, the lead to gasoline one is science. Next one, oldest vampiropod, amazing name, squid fossil discovered 328 million years ago indicates the common ancestors between squid and octopuses had only two arms. So Steve, can I ask a clarifying question here?
Yeah.
Are you distinguishing between arms and tentacles?
No, that the arms are tentacles.
Arms are tentacles. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, sure. Like, things change during evolution. That sounds plausible. If you had asked me to guess how many arms a common ancestor had, I probably would have said more than zero, but, any number there, I don't know. So that sounds plausible. I'm going to hold off on that and move to the next one. A study of linguistic convergence finds that people imitate speech they hear, even parts of speech they do not hear but anticipate, such as imitating parts of a Southern American accent. I don't understand what this is saying.
Yes, yeah, so let me. This is hard to summarize in a sentence. I'll be happy to explain it to you. So in the experiment, the idea was that like if you start to sound like people that you're around, right? You hear people talking in an accent, like even as an adult, you'll start to move in the direction of that accent in terms of how you pronounce things, how you pronounce values. Vowels. Yeah. You'll take on a little bit of a Southern twang, even if you're a Yankee, right? If you're around people. So what they did in the experiment was that they exposed people to the Southern accent, and they started to imitate parts of a Southern accent they were not exposed to in the experiment.
So they extrapolated one part of the accent
to
the
what
rest.
They were hearing to the rest. Yeah, that's correct.
I mean, that also sounds plausible. Okay, so I have no real basis for judging which of two or three I think is the fiction, but I'm going to say it is number two because I think it's the two arms that's possibly wrong.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see. All right, so for the lead and the gasoline. Yeah, I mean, lead's bad stuff. I could see. Yeah, I remember the days when you got regular gas or unleaded. So yeah, that's as horrible stuff. I can imagine that would cause wholesale loss of certain IQ points per person exposed to that in the atmosphere. So, yeah, that kind of makes sense. The speech one, yeah, I could see that. It's not totally surprising. The one that's my main problem, though, is with number two, this vampiropod. Very cool. Very awesome name. The thing is, though, in the world that I live in, the tentacles wouldn't go down in the past. I think, I don't think they went in that direction. I think they went in the other direction. I think the common ancestors had like 1,000 tentacles. That's what.
Well, you always just want more tentacles.
More tentacles. more Cthulhu like. So I'm going to go.
Yeah, it goes all the way back to Cthulhu.
For Cthulhu, I'm going to say that that's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Steve, I'm just going to keep it clean. I'm going to go with Bob. I think that the.
No, dude, you're going with Brian. Yeah, come on.
It's still GWB.
I share genetic material with
just
Bob
insulting at this point.
I definitely think Bob is correct. I think they went in the wrong direction.
Oh, my God.
Okay, and Kara.
So quick back of the napkin calculation. What I think that you're saying in the very first one about lead, not so much lead poisoning, but just kind of exposure to lead, is that about half of Americans basically were negatively impacted by this, which mm-hmm. would make sense because probably about half of Americans live near exhaust on a regular basis. And even though this sounds bananas when you first hear these numbers, if you divide that out, that's about 5 IQ points, a little less than 5 IQ points. On average, I wouldn't be surprised by that because we know that children who like eat lead paint have profound cognitive deficits from it. So there's probably a lot of variability. The linguistic convergence one, it has to be science. I do this all the time and all my friends make fun of me for it when I go to the UK. And then I have this like lilt in the way that I talk. And I'm like, are we going there now? Are we going there now? I can't even do it right now.
Yeah, but is it for the stuff you haven't heard yet? That's the complicated
It's just how I talk. How I talk. So it's not like I'm imitating words. I actually pick up sort of the tonality and the musicality of the language more than anything. Yeah. And yeah, I think even you guys gave me hell for that, I think, the last time we were there together. And the one that bugs me is the Vampiropod one. That doesn't bug me. Love the name, just like you, Bob. I don't know if it's more or less. For me, what bothers me is that I'm pretty sure, tell me if I'm wrong, Steve, but I'm pretty sure that octopuses, squids, these different animals, they have radial symmetry. They would never have two arms. That's like bilateral symmetry.
You could have them on opposite side, though, couldn't you? And still
could be
radially,
but you almost
symmetric.
Never see that. You almost never see that. Usually, when you see two arms in something, they're opposing each other, and it's not a radial. Like they're not mirrored all the way around. They're mirrored as though there's a line down the center of the body. And so, I think it's just some number of arms. I have no idea how many that would be in a circle. And I don't think two arms makes a circle. So that's why that one's getting me.
Okay, so you all agree on the Vampiropod, but we'll start with number one. We'll take them in order. A new study calculates that the addition of lead to gasoline in the 20th century resulted in a loss of 824 million IQ points for more than 170 million Americans. Yeah, that's spread out across those 170 million Americans alive today. That one is science. So there's a pretty strong consensus that exposure to lead can sap you of a couple of IQ points. What's controversial about the lead is whether or not it correlates with increase in crime. Right. That's one that's been hard to nail down. But the decrease in IQ points has been pretty consistent in the literature.
Okay.
There's also a theory that is remains popular. I don't know how rock solid it is, but that adding lead to wine in ancient Rome and using lead pipes, etc., actually could have led to the downfall of the Roman Empire, you know, in the extreme. But I mean, the similar phenomenon basically of, you know, Romans losing IQ points because of, you know, fairly extensive exposure to lead is a viable theory as well. What its historical impact was is a matter of speculation, but that was probably true as well. So yeah, minimizing lead in our environment, minimizing all human exposure to lead is a good thing. Yeah, it's a good thing. Definitely a goal. Okay, let's go on to number two, the oldest vampiropod. Squid fossil discovered 328 million years old indicates that the common ancestors between squid and octopuses had only two arms. You guys all think this is science. Now, Kara, you know what modern squids look like, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have how many arms?
Eight.
They have 10, who's a bobtail?
10, of course, 10.
Right? They have 8 regular, like, octopus-sized ones, plus they have those 2 super long ones.
Long ones. Is there a distinction? I remember reading somewhere that it's like the long ones are the tentacles and the short ones are the arms. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. Technically, yes. The short ones are the arms. Those 2 long ones are the tentacles. They're all limbs. I guess you would use the nonspecific term. So I guess all the cephalopods have 8 arms, but the squids and some of the other things, I think like cuttlefish, additionally have the 2 tentacles. The difference is the arms have the suckers all the way down. The tentacles only have suckers at the end, which is also like an expanded bulb at the end of the limb.
Okay.
So they're just modified arms.
Yeah, but they do have the 2, right? You know, just by itself.
Okay. Well, that makes me nervous, but
yeah. So the question did they start with those 2 and then evolve the extra ones? So first, we essentially, before we found this fossil, did not have the common ancestor. Now, vampiropods are interesting because they're called squid, but they're actually closer to octopuses than other squid.
Mm.
They have 8 arms. But we didn't have any really early vampiropods to know what their common ancestor had. And they found a vampiropod 328 million years old. So it's the oldest one we know of. It definitely puts it back into the common ancestor from vampiropods and octopuses. And it has 10 arms. Octopuses lost those 2 arms, those 2 extra long ones that squid have, is basically what that means.
Mm-hmm.
The common ancestors had 10 arms. And they named the species, so vampiropod is the genus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Guess who they named the species after? And you guys, this is in the
Squidward?
Like in the mainstream news, so you may have seen it, after Joe Biden.
Really? Right,
so it's like Vampirotuthis Bidenus or something?
Yeah.
What is it?
The group is called Vampiropoda, Vampiropoda, Thlipsimopodi Bideni.
Why would you name that after Joe Biden?
I have
because
no
he's
idea.
President. Like, oh my god!
I guess so. But there you go. That's why it's in the news, because it's got named after Biden in the mainstream news. It's in the science news, obviously, because it's cool science. Yeah. So that is the fiction. So you guys are all correct. This also means that a study of linguistic convergence finds that people imitate speech they hear, even parts of speech they do not hear but anticipate, such as imitating parts of a Southern American accent they were not exposed to in the experiment. That is science. So yeah, that's not, I didn't think this was too unusual. And this is what the researchers were expecting. But it was the first time they came up with an experimental model where they actually tested it. And they did use a Southern American accent, you know, Southern accent. And they, you know, had people exposed to words like, you know, ride and dine. And then they tracked, and also to like a Midwestern accent. They controlled what they were being exposed to. And then they would say other vowels that they did not hear at all, they would start to pronounce them in more of a Southern accent type of way.
Makes sense. It's like where you're changing where the vowels are located in your mouth, and you kind of find a pattern or something like that, right? And you just imitate it.
Yeah. So that's the question, is now is it that they're imitating something that's more fundamental about the speech that they're then extrapolating to other parts of speech, or are they just remembering what the archetypal Southern accent is supposed to sound like? And that's I think, where the researchers went, because essentially what the people were imitating was not necessarily a genuine Southern accent, but a caricature of a Southern accent. It's the archetype of what they think a Southern accent is, which is interesting, right? So they're just sort of, I'm now supposed to be speaking in a Southern accent. They sort of drifting towards what in their mind is a Southern accent, even though it isn't, and even though they're not being exposed to it.
Right. So the interesting thing would be if there was like a new accent they'd never heard before, what would
happen? Yes.
Right.
Right. That would be interesting to do. That would be a good control experiment. They didn't do that in this particular study. That would be a really good follow-up experiment. Is to see what, you know, would there still be some kind of extrapolation or not? Or maybe would there even be any imitation? There probably would still be imitation, but, you know, maybe there might not be this anticipatory phenomenon? Is the anticipatory phenomenon dependent on prior exposure? Right? Yeah. Because that's
you
the
show them like a Cornish accent or something, and you're like,
yeah,
you know, ask them to guess, yeah.
Right, or that the accent from that the check from that show Finding Anna or something, guys. Right, that what, mm-hmm. guys watch that on Netflix where mm-hmm. the it's a story about this girl who pretended to be like a Russian German.
Oh, you know, yeah, I know yeah. that socialite. Story, and I've heard her weird like in real life her weird accent.
Yeah,
it's bananas. It's it the weirdest nuts,
yeah.
accent.
It's like this it's fake wild. Weird accent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's the name of that show?
Inventing Anna.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Her performance, the actress's performance, same actress who played a character on Ozark with a really like Midwestern twang, and she's British. Like her native accent is British, but she could, I mean, amazing, amazing actress. Apparently she like completely nails this person's accent, but the accent itself is like, what the hell am I listening to? Like it sounds just really bizarre. Have you guys heard people? Like, I've had people that I've heard, you know, that in real life, that had an accent I couldn't place.
Sure. Yeah, one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because it was from a country I'm not familiar with. It was because they had some kind of
amalgamation.
Like a hybrid accent. It's like, it's like I'm from here, but I learned English there. And like their accent is like a blending of these two things. It's like they're
one
speaking.
One of the people I am closest to in my life is Scottish, but mm-hmm. his parents are from Zimbabwe. And his accent is so hard
awesome.
To place. Like nobody in Scotland thinks he's Scottish because mm-hmm. he doesn't have a thick brogue. But so everybody thinks he's English. But then when he's in England, people are like, you don't sound English, mate. Like I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
It's this really interesting, but he was born and raised in Scotland. He just happens to have Zimbabwean parents who have a very Zimbabwean accent. And he's mm-hmm. like some of it kind of, I guess, rubbed off on him.
I always think about the Jewish people that fled to Mexico City, like in the mm-hmm. 30s. And, you know, Mexico City has that real sing-songy kind of accent. I'd love to hear that amazing hybrid, whatever that became.
Yeah,
I had a friend,
two, like,
I had a friend whose
different.
Parents were Mexico City Jewish people who, you know, and then he moved to America later. But he grew up with a perfect Mexican accent. But I always wonder what his parents sounded like, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, the a lot of people ask about the Novella Boys accent, and actually we have I think it's less as the older we get, but because just again exposure to more, you know, people. But when we grew up, we had a Danbury accent, a very regional accent, but contaminated by our mother's Brooklyn accent, which is contaminated by Queens. So my mother had like a Brooklyn Queens accent, and she completely infected us with her accent. So we had this hybrid, essentially New York Danbury, like
you guys sound very New York,
Connecticut. Yeah, of course we do. Yeah, because well, if you're outside of New England, then you think we sound like people from that region. Like I've had people think that we have like a New York accent. I've had people think that we had a Boston accent, which
whoa.
To me is crazy.
No way.
No way.
But to them,
not.
Again, that's like us saying you have a Southern accent
right.
to somebody from Alabama.
Which is so
like not distinguishing
from Texas.
An Alabama from a Texas accent, right?
Or
Mississippi accent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But to them, it's like, are you crazy? That's Alabama. I'm from Mississippi. But to us, like, yeah, New York and Boston sound nothing alike. But to somebody outside of the Northeast, they might think it all sounds the same to them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's weird to think about that. But yeah, we have a hybrid accent. Yeah, totally. I think we've gotten rid of a lot of the Brooklyn, though. When we were younger, it was definitely thicker.
Sure.
But you definitely have an accent.
Oh, yeah.
I remember talking.
There's no not having an accent.
Jay, I remember talking to your wife the last time that we were all hanging out, and she was like, "You have such a thick accent to me." And I was like, "What are you talking about,
you?
Courtney?" I was like, "I have like a neutral broadcast accent. You have a thick accent." She was like, "No, I don't have an accent. You have an accent." I was like, "That's so funny that we hear where each other is from, but not our own."
Yeah. Kara, mm-hmm. do I sound like I have an accent to you? Do I sound like I have an East Coast accent?
Not heavy, no. I know that you grew up where my ex-boyfriend grew up,
that's
kind
right.
of around the same time.
North
and
Jersey,
you sound
yeah.
kind of like him. Like he said when he was young, he would say things like walk the dog because he also grew
oh, sure.
up. Yeah, and like water. But now it only comes out when he says my name. He says like Kara.
Kara.
Yeah.
Kara. Yeah, see, Kara would be the Danbury accent.
Yeah.
Oh, and he's more Danbury. Like Kara, but he also kind of grew up in like Jersey, but
Kara?
Also Westchester.
And, well, and also, yeah.
So what the hell
when
is
you
it
move
then?
Around a lot, like. It kind of goes away.
Right. He's Jersey, right? You're Jersey.
Yeah, I'm North. I grew up in North Jersey, but then Jersey? You know, I lived. I lived all around the country while I was doing physics, and then I was a professor in London.
Right.
And so, like, I got zero British accent, some British vocabulary, but definitely did not affect my accent. But yeah, I moved around. I mean, I spent so many years in, you know, moving around for physics that I think it pretty much got watered down.
Yeah, but you have a generic Northeastern accent,
yes.
I would say.
I think that's fair.
Yeah,
I definitely don't have
like
a Southern
accent. Strong.
No.
It's not like, like that very New York accent. My mom apparently used to have that, but now she lives in the South, so it's like her accent's a little confusing, but it's still pretty neutral. Certain things come out. And sometimes people tell me I sound Texan. There's certain words I say that sound Texan, but I don't think I have a very Texas accent.
I will say, when I watch The Sopranos, it's like, that feels like home.
Yeah.
I find that I can emulate a Southern accent easier than other accents, even though I don't talk like that. I grew up around it in my family.
Oh, yeah, that
sounds
makes sense.
Like that.
Sure.
So it's easy for me to imitate it.
I think that's kind of a generic thing, though. A lot of people from other countries, when they want to imitate an American accent, they go to Southern.
Right,
first.
But it's like Steve was talking about. It's like a caricature. I think I can actually emulate a Texas accent.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
Whereas a lot of times people are like, I'm from the South. And I'm like, nobody talks like that. What is
or
that?
Like, you know, like to us, like if you got, I'm sure you guys have heard somebody who's British imitating all the different British accents, you know?
Yes. Oh, that's amazing.
Oh, that's, I love that so much.
Like to us, it's, I mean, I could, like when I was younger, it was just all one accent to me. But, you know, we've had so much exposure. Like I could, I don't know that I could imitate it, but I could tell like a Londoner accent from a Northern accent.
Yeah.
You know,
that's,
you know,
about what I can do now.
Yeah, yeah, versus a Liverpool accent. Obviously, everyone knows that.
Yeah, that one's
Beatles.
Pretty obvious.
Yeah, but...
Or Manchester, or maybe Birmingham or something.
Yeah, right.
But different sub-regions. Yeah, that's really, really hard to do.
Yeah, but you know, but they're obviously people from England, from Great Britain, from the UK, can like nail these local accents that in a way that blows me away. But I think it'd be the same thing. Like, you know, we could probably do a lot better job at imitating a Boston versus New York accent, you know, versus a New Hampshire accent, you know, and even a Connecticut accent in a way that somebody not from the region would not be able to do.
There's a New Hampshire accent?
Yeah, I was just going to say, what the hell is a New Hampshire
I don't
accent?
I know what that is.
I don't know.
Pepperidge Farm.
Right? Yeah,
you can't get there from here.
Like,
I thought that was
like
more
Maine.
Yeah, but that's a rural accent. That accent. See, that's the thing. You're conflating them. That's the you can't get there from here. That's a rural New England accent. That's not a Boston accent.
You sound like JFK. Can't get there from here. That's amazing. My favorite, I have to say, my favorite, least favorite is Baltimore. It's the most bananas accent in our country.
Yeah. I lived there for 5 years.
It's the weirdest. Oh, my gosh. Did you get used to it?
No.
Baltimore. They call it Baltimore. There's a YouTube video I love to show people where this guy is showing, like, he writes words on cards and shows them to all his family members and has them pronounce them. And the one that kills me, Amblance.
Really?
Yeah. That's take awesome. The Amblance. I can't. It's amazing.
It's so great.
I love it. Accents are so fun.
Yeah.
They're super interesting. Also, you know, there's not just regional accents. There's obviously cultural accents, and there's socioeconomic accents.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And,
I
watched a really good documentary on this. The socioeconomic accents actually trump regional accents. Did you know that?
Mm. Yes,
I could see that.
A rich person from London and a rich person from Boston sound more alike than either do to lower socioeconomic classes in their own region.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and even when you look at like old American recordings, like sort of the elite social class, they all kind of talked like this.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Like what is
very
that?
Open vowels.
Yeah,
like the rich Boston accent was the guy from MASH, the rich Boston doctor from MASH. What's his name?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yep.
Charles Emerson Winchester III. He sounded a little British, but he was supposed to be from Boston, but he didn't sound like, you know, Ben Affleck, you know, Boston accent.
Yeah. Right.
You know. Anyway, we are endlessly fascinated with accents. I thought you guys would love
totally.
that science fiction. But good, you know, so last week I swept you. This week you guys swept me. So congratulations.
And I am still undefeated.
Still undefeated.
Good job, Ryan. Awesome.
Unless I'm wrong about that, of course.
Yeah. Well, but, whatever. Yeah. No one's going to check up on you. Except people will definitely check up on you. All right, Jay, since Evan's not here, you're going to give us a quote this week.
Yeah, I found a really adorable quote. I don't know if you guys have heard this before. It's something to do with Richard Feynman. If you don't know who Richard Feynman was, he was a very famous American theoretical physicist. He worked with quantum electrodynamics. This is about how light interacts with matter and how charged particles interact with each other. He's one of my favorite scientists, very, very interesting person. So something fun happened to him. Richard Feynman was named the smartest man in the world by Omni magazine. This was like a science and, you know, science popularizing type magazine back in the 70s and 80s. So when he was named this, his mother said, "Are Richie the world's smartest man? God help us." Richard Feynman's mom. She's awesome.
That is so like.
That's really funny.
Totally.
I know, right? So it's. I thought that was so freaking cute.
That is.
Oh,
funny.
God.
I had a letter to the editor published in Omni magazine once.
Really?
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I was like 14, 15.
What was it about?
I still remember. It was stupid. It was an article about how there are these big gaps in the universe when you look out there. And the article was about maybe those gaps are there because of intergalactic war that destroyed multiple galaxies.
I remember this, Steve. I remember this.
I wrote it a letter about how stupid that was.
It's so cute, though.
Yeah.
If anyone listening doesn't know Omni, look up the covers because the design is just the best. It's so 80s.
The covers were awesome.
The covers were. And just that curvy kind of NASA-y font. Oh, I mean, it just screams 1980s. It's the best.
I love that magazine, even though it was very pop, you know. All right, well, Brian, it's been a blast having you back on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me back.
You got it, brother. Hey, we'll see you at the No Show 2, and that is happening when? April 23rd.
April 23rd.
We'll see you then. Actually, I'll see you in about 3 minutes when I come down and get those files from you.
Yeah.
Remember to join us Friday, 5 o'clock Eastern Time for the live stream. And otherwise, we will see you next week. And until then, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.